I'm very grateful for this opportunity of paying this visit to this great university. It's a very great privilege for me to participate with you in this assembly. And I'd like to congratulate you upon being here. The fact that you're here enrolled in this great university tells me a great many things about the kind of people that you are. Now, I appreciate that the reason that one might be invited to occupy this position is the hope that you might have that he might bring some benefit to this occasion. I'm not sure that I can do that, though I promise you that I would like to. But I'm going to try to say something to you about what to me is the most important, or certainly one of the most important things there is in our lives. And as a starting point for some of the things that I'd like to say to you, I'm going to tell you a story. Recently, it was my very pleasant privilege to read Lewis Fisher's book, The Life of Mohandas K. Gandhi. This is a story of a little 102-pound colored man in India who went around four-fifths naked, who lived in a mud hut which never had a telephone or an electric light or running water, who never had an automobile. He had no wealth, no diplomats, no armies. He never sought or ever held a public office. And yet the British government soon discovered that they could not rule India against Gandhi, and they could not rule India without Gandhi. The people understood that Gandhi was absolutely honest, that he could be trusted, that his motives were right. They knew that when he said something, that was exactly what he meant. Now, I'd like to have you think just for a minute what a great advantage that gives a person if people understand that he has these qualities in his character. But Gandhi's early life was very unpromising. He thought of himself as a coward. He had a very bad temper. He had some very serious sex problems. Gandhi was married by the time he was 13 years of age, and he had been engaged 3 times before that time. But realizing the disadvantages that these unfavorable qualities of personality gave Gandhi, he started out deliberately to remake his personality, and he calls himself later a self-remade man. Now, if you'd like to have a good phrase, I recommend that one to you. But Gandhi did a lot of things to make himself the kind of man that he thought he would like to be. For example, he went on these long fasts that you've heard about for discipline. He said, "How can I control others if I cannot control myself?" Gandhi took ideas and words seriously. He believed that when he accepted an idea in principle and didn't practice it, he was being dishonest. His greatness lay in doing what everybody could but did not do. I'd like to give you one or two examples of some of the things that he did to make of himself the person that he wanted to be. His mother, for example, taught him that to eat meat was wrong. She reasoned that eating meat necessitated the destruction of other life, and therefore it was wrong. And so Gandhi took a pledge to his mother that he would remain a strict vegetarian throughout his life. Later, after his mother's death, some of his friends tried to persuade him that there was no life in unfertilized eggs, and therefore he could eat these without violating his pledge. But Gandhi knew what his mother's definition of meat was, and inasmuch as he had taken the pledge from her, her definition must remain binding. Later on, when Gandhi was very ill and it was not known whether he would live or not, some of his physicians tried to persuade him to take a little beef broth to save his life. But Gandhi said, "Even for life itself, we may not do certain things. There is only one course open to me, to die, but never to break my pledge." But by the sheer power of this self-made personality, Gandhi raised himself to be the unquestioned leader of 500 million people, and became the greatest single power in India, and probably in the world. And Lewis Fisher calls this process by which a below-average human being can raise himself to great heights of accomplishment and power. Mr. Fisher calls this process the miracle of personality. Now, I'd like to have you think, if you would, just for a minute, what would happen in the world? What would be the benefit to the world if all of the leaders of great nations and all of the rest of us had Gandhi's kind of integrity? And in this term that President Wilkinson has announced about, I think of personality, or I speak of it in its most inclusive sense. You might call it character or personality, but I'm including all of the things that a person is, his habits and attitudes, and in that very inclusive sense. Now, the thing that I'm going to try to say to you today is that the greatest value in the world are those great potentialities within yourself. And the most profitable thing that you can do, or that anyone can do, in my opinion, is to develop those qualities that often lie undeveloped in human personality. Now, I'm speaking to you today. I'm a businessman. I'm speaking to you as a businessman. I'd like you to think of this question, or ask yourself what it is, why some people attract to themselves more success, bigger incomes, more honor, all of these other things than some other people do. And I say attract, I suppose it's true that all of us are in reality human magnets. I think of this story about the ancient Chinese. It's said that there were a group of ancient Chinese that had a custom that if you were to visit in one of their homes and you admire a certain object in their home, you may find that this Chinese would wrap this particular thing up and send it to you as a present. You admired it, and so you get it. And that's a thing that life does to us. Whatever you admire, whatever you truly love and appreciate, you get. If you love honesty, you get honesty. If you love friendship, you get friendship. If you love integrity and industry and all of these other great qualities, that life wraps them up and sends them to you as a present. The great William James said, "That which holds our attention determines our action." The mind is made up by what it feeds upon. You put things in your mind and your personality is colored accordingly. Someone has said that the mind, like a dyer's hand, is colored by what it holds. That is, if I hold in my hand a sponge of purple dye, my hand becomes purple. Now, if I hold in my mind certain ideas, my personality is made up accordingly. Jesus said, "What a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." Now, I'd like to give you an illustration, and maybe an illustration from a bad source, but in 1923, Adolf Hitler sat in a prison cell in Germany, writing out his plans to make Germany the greatest nation on the earth. Now, at that time, Hitler was without friends, without money, without education, without a past successful experience, and yet he was writing in this book, Mein Kampf, how he would make Germany the greatest power on the earth. And you know, of course, how nearly he succeeded, almost to destroy the earth. Now, if you'd ask yourself how he did that, the answer is written in his book. He said, "The question of Germany regaining her power is not how to manufacture and distribute arms, but how to produce in people that will to win, that spirit of determination, which produces 1,000 different methods, each of which ends with arms." Now, of course, Hitler fought in a bad cause, but he understood, as we should understand, that the secret of power is not in armaments, but in human personality. The right kind of personality, properly motivated, can reach any objective. There are some lines that I've memorized because I think they're helpful. I like to say them occasionally. The human will, that force unseen, that offspring of a human soul, can hew a way to any goal, though walls of granite intervene. Be not impatient in delay, but wait as one who understands. When spirit rises and commands, the gods are ready to obey. Now, this, to me, is the miracle of personality. Now, I suppose that one of the first things in our quest for success, one of the first things we ought to think about is what we want. What is it in life? We should have an objective. Now, without an objective, we don't get very far. It's a funny thing to me, and I have to do with quite a lot of people, but it has always appeared strange that many people don't have an objective. They don't have a daily standard to qualify their performance. They just go ahead and do what they can, and now that's a mistake, because we always do better when we have a goal. And I'd like to give you another illustration. At one time, no one could swim the English Channel, and then Captain Webb did it, and then an automobile company in 1926 made an offer of a red Buick convertible automobile and $2,500 in cash for the first woman who would swim the English Channel. And there was a young American girl, 19 years old, by the name of Gertrude Ederle. And Gertrude Ederle wanted this automobile. She could think of all of the things that she could do if she had this red Buick convertible automobile and $2,500 in cash. And I can appreciate how much she wanted it, because I have a boy about that age who's had an automobile for a few months, and that's the only thing he can talk about. He just about drives us out of the house. He just loves to talk about this automobile. And I suppose that Gertrude Ederle had a similar situation in her mind, and so she wanted this automobile, and she decided to swim the English Channel. But partway across the channel, she gave out. She was completely exhausted. She couldn't go another stroke. But before she was taken out of the water, she lay there, and in her imagination, this red Buick convertible automobile passed in front of her mind, which gave her a great new surge of power to go on and become the first woman ever to swim the English Channel. Now, when we get our objective in our mind, when we know where we want to go, that is, if Gertrude Ederle had just been out for a swim, if she'd just been swimming until she got tired, she never, of course, would have been successful in swimming the channel. Now, when we have an objective firmly fixed in our minds, and then when we have a little bit of confidence in ourselves that we'll be able to accomplish it, then great things happen. I have here some other lines, which says, "The average runner sprints until the breath in him is gone, but the champion has that iron will that makes him carry on. For rest, the average runner begs when limp his muscles grow, but the champion runs on leaden legs. His spirit makes them go. The average man's complacent when he's done his best to score, but the champion does his best, and then he does a little more." Now, one of the things I'd like to say to you is that we must have an objective. There are many people, I see a lot of people who are not ready for success. And I speak of success in its highest sense, in the sense that you're thinking of it. But there are a lot of people who are not ready for success. There are a lot of people who are just not ready to succeed. We heard some years ago President Roosevelt tell about the four great American freedoms. And one of these was the freedom from want. Now, I can think of something that I think at least is far more important in our lives than the freedom from want, and that is the freedom to want. And it's a thrilling thing to me to think of you here in this great institution, under the leadership of these great leaders and instructors that you have, to have this fine education which you will be permitted to have, and then on top of that you can want as much as you please and anything that you please, and you can reach any objective if you have an objective, and then you have the confidence to reach it. Now, the thing that I'm trying to say to you is that the one business of life is to succeed. We're not placed here to waste our lives in failure. And, of course, we must have the objective, and we must want to reach it. We must want in capital letters. I've heard a story, I suppose you have, one of the stories of Socrates. You remember that Socrates lived in ancient Greece, and he had a great reputation for learning and wisdom and understanding. And a young man came to Socrates one day, and he said, "Mr. Socrates, I've come 1,500 miles. You have this great reputation for learning. I want learning, so I've come to you, and you give me learning." Now, of course, that's a little bit difficult, as you could understand, but Socrates was equal to the occasion, and he said, "Come follow me." So they went down to the seashore, and they waded out into the water until they were up to their waists, and then Socrates took this man by the head and forced his head under the water. And the more he struggled and kicked and spit, the harder Socrates held him down, until all of the resistance had gone out of him, and then Socrates took him up on the bank and laid him there to sort of thaw out, and he went back to the marketplace. And this man, when he revived a little bit, went back to the marketplace and to find out from Socrates the reason for this unusual behavior. And Socrates said to him, "What was the one thing you wanted when you had your head under the water more than anything else?" And he said, "I wanted air." Now Socrates said, "When you want knowledge and understanding as badly as you wanted air, you won't have to ask anybody." Now, I'll give you a recipe if you'd like to have better marks than you're getting. Now, I suppose you all get the top grades, but if you want better marks than you're now getting, when you want it as badly as this young man, and if you want to find out how to want, have somebody hold your head under the water for a little while, and then you want good marks as much as you want, as you'd want air under that circumstance, and you'll get good marks, and I promise that that'll be true. Now, I'm going to try to hold up before you, if I can, some of these great qualities of what I call personality. That isn't maybe a very good term, but it's the best I can think of. But physicians study medicine by comparing diseased and healthy bodies. Now, we study success by comparing diseased and healthy personalities. I'm sure that some of you have seen this current Technicolor moving picture based on Sir Walter Scott's great novel of Ivanhoe. This is a story, as you remember, of the lion-hearted King Richard, who ruled England in the latter part of the 12th century, who organized a crusade to the Holy Land. He wanted to dispossess the land of Palestine from the Turks, but the expedition was unsuccessful, and Richard himself was captured and confined to a foreign prison. During his absence from England, some traitors at home took over the government of England, and when Richard finally effected his escape and returned to England, it was necessary, for reasons of his own personal security, to come disguised in plain armor. And quietly he gathered about him a few of his faithful followers and began the process of putting England back in the hands of its rightful rulers. And one of the first things that he had did was to attack the castle of Torquilstone, a stronghold of the enemy in which his friend and follower Ivanhoe was wounded and imprisoned. When Ivanhoe heard the noises of assault beginning to take place outside the castle, and being very interested in whatever was having to do with this castle, he asked his nurse, Rebecca, to stand by the window and tell him what was taking place. And one of the first things he wanted to know, of course, was who the leader was. The character of the leader is important to any undertaking. And so Rebecca stood by the window, and he asked her to describe to him the insignia, the marks of identification on the armor of the leader, so that he might know who he was. But Rebecca reported back to Ivanhoe that the leader fought in plain, unmarked armor, that there were no marks of identification. And then Ivanhoe said to her to describe to him the actions of the leader. Now, if you can see a man act, if you can see a man perform, you can usually tell what he is. These great qualities of character and personality cannot be concealed even by steel armor. And so Rebecca described this great warrior as he led this assault. She told of how he swung this ponderous axe with thunderous blows. She said, "Stones and beams are hurled down from the castle walls upon him, but he regards them no more than if they were thistledown or feathers." She said again, "He fights as if there were 20 men's strength in his single arm." During this description, Ivanhoe could think of no one but the king, and yet he thought that the king was a prisoner in a foreign dungeon. But Rebecca again said, "It is fearful yet magnificent to behold how the arm and heart of one man can triumph over hundreds." Now, I suppose that Richard's arm wasn't greatly different than any other warrior's arm, but that isn't where strength comes from. Richard was fighting with his heart. He was fighting with he was fighting for England. Now, as I and Ivanhoe paid one of the greatest tributes to leadership that I have ever heard, not knowing who this man was, but knowing only from his actions of his greatness, knowing of his courage and all of these other things, Ivanhoe said this. He said, "I swear by the honor of my house, I would endure 10 years captivity to fight a single day by that great man's side in such a quarrel as this." Now, Ivanhoe admired these qualities of character in the life of his king, so he attracted them to himself. We're all magnets. We attract those things that we like. Now, on January the 20th, I listened to our great soldier president give his inaugural address, and as he spoke, I thought of the lion-hearted soldier king of England. It seemed to me that our soldier president was also fighting with his heart. In fact, he said, what America hopes to bring to pass in the world must first come to pass in the heart of America. And he might have said, whatever America hopes to bring to pass in America must first come to pass in the hearts of Americans. He also said that the great driving forces are not intellectual, but emotional. It's the things we feel, it's the things we want that make a difference in our lives. Now, what the Brigham Young University hopes to bring to pass in the world must first come to pass in the hearts of the faculty and the students of this great institution. And I think that, and one of the things I'd like to underline, if I may, is that the greatest fault, I think, in human beings is that we underestimate ourselves. It's hard for us to imagine a situation which we haven't experienced. It's hard for you to imagine the great things that you're going to do later on in your life because there are things that haven't come to pass as yet. It's hard for us to have faith in something that is yet to be realized. Now, before we get these qualities of greatness, we must believe in them. We must think of them of ourselves. And here again are some other lines entitled Achievement, which says, trust in thine own untried capacity as thou wouldst trust in God himself. Thy soul is but an emanation from the whole. Thou dost not dream what forces lie in thee, vast and unfathomed as the grandest sea. No man can place a limit in thy strength. Such triumphs as no mortal ever dreamed may yet be thine if thou wilt but believe in thy Creator and thyself. At length some feet shall stand on heights now unattained. Why not thine own? Press on. Achieve. Achieve. Now it seems to me that the most important words that have ever been spoken are these. And God created man in his own image. Now, when you come up against the problems that you have here or that you will have later on, you remember that in you are all of the attributes of divinity put there for development. I've read a number of times this great story of creation, but the creation of man is not something that was finished and done with 6,000 years ago. The creation of man is still going on. The creation of man is taking place at this university, and you are the creators, the faculty, the officers are the creators. That is, you are creating in your lives the attitudes and the enthusiasm and the spirituality which will make of you the person that you're intended to be. And I hope this doesn't sound too ecclesiastical. I'm speaking to you as a businessman. I'm speaking to you as someone who understands a little bit that these great qualities are tremendously valuable in business and, of course, every place else. Now, wealth isn't so much what we have. Wealth is mostly what we are. I hold in my hand a black walnut that I picked up the other day. This has a shell-like stone. It has a lot of little stony reinforcements inside of it, and then in between is a little unintelligent, unimportant, meaty substance which has in it some mysterious and tremendous power. That is, if you plant this nut under certain circumstances, a heat is produced inside. Now, whether it's a nut or whether it's a businessman or a student, when we begin to get hot inside. Now, I'm sure you think the professors put a lot of heat on from the outside, but that doesn't do much good. The only heat that does things is when it gets inside. But when this nut begins to get warm inside, it produces a power which breaks that stony shell as though it were paper. And a little shoot comes out which, under the right circumstances, becomes a great walnut tree. That is, there's some mysterious power in the inside of this little object which has the ability to attract out of the elements of the soil and the air and the water all of the ingredients necessary to make a great walnut tree, including wood and foliage and blossoms and fragrance and fruit. Now, every human being, every one of you, has inside of him all of the things necessary to attract out of your environment all of those things to make you a great human being. Someone has said that in nature there are 98 elements. There's hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and iron and so on. These are nature's building blocks. Out of these, nature may fashion a mountain or a pine tree or a mouse or an elephant or an ocean or a volcano. That is, if you want to make an ocean, you take two parts of hydrogen and one of oxygen and mix them together and you have an ocean. I suppose it isn't quite that simple, but that's the general idea. Then someone has said that in human personality, there are 51 elements. There's kindness and honesty and courage and industry and all of these other qualities, which mix together in the right proportions, you come up with what somebody has called a magnificent human being. Shakespeare mentioned one such when he said his life was gentle and the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, here was a man. Out of these qualities and inside of each of you, this miracle, you have a little architect which fashions what you're going to be. And out of these qualities which are given to you in great abundance, you may fashion a Napoleon or a Caesar or a Gandhi or a Lincoln. Now, none of us want to be any of them. What is more important, it fashions this unique personality of which there are no others in the world, which is yourself. Now, the greatest of all the miracles is this miracle of personality. It has been said that 85% of all of your success is going to depend on these on this thing that I'm trying to describe to you. Walter Dill Scott at one time said that mental attitude was more important than mental capacity. Now, we'd all like to have great capacity, but mental attitude is more important than that. Now, I'd like to tell you another story. Back in ancient times, and there's reference to this made in the Bible, there was a little group of people who had a very peculiar way of punishing crime. That is, if one committed murder, his punishment was that he was chained to the body of his victim. That is, if I should shoot President Wilkinson, well, if President Wilkinson should shoot me, his punishment would be, according to this regulation, that he would be chained to his sin, me. Now, that wouldn't be very important probably for tonight or in the morning, but what about in 3 weeks from now or 2 years from now? Wherever he would go forevermore, he must drag with him his crime. Now, that seems a horrible punishment, but nature has a plan of retribution that's just exactly like that. We're always chained to our crime. That is, if you violate the law of temperance, your punishment is that a ruinous, driving thirst attaches itself to you, and you must drag it with you wherever you go forevermore. If you become dishonest, if you are dishonest, the dishonesty incarnates itself. It becomes a part of your personality. The punishment of one who tells lies is that he eventually becomes a liar. That is, we are not only punished for our sins, we are punished by our sins. Now, it's hard to succeed in the race of life if we're loaded down with a lot of dead, putrefying corpses. We drag our sins with us. They incarnate themselves. That is, if you fail to study, and here's the greatest threat I could give to you, if you fail to study, your sentence is that you must drag with you your ignorance forevermore throughout your life. That's the punishment. The mark doesn't make any difference. It makes some difference, I'm sure, but the important thing is that you're tied to your sin. Now, the Scripture says that there are a lot of sins that can't be forgiven in this world or in the world to come, and I guess this personality part of it is a part of those. That is, it's very difficult to step between an act and the natural consequences. That is, a governor may pardon a murderer, but he cannot restore life. The natural consequences of the crime remain untouched by the pardon. There's an old fable that says a horse once ran away from its master. And then the horse repented and came back and said to the master, I have come back. And the master said, yes, you've come back, but the field is unplowed. The prodigal son returned to his father, but the substance could not be recovered. And the scars were still there in the personality of the prodigal. Now, it's pretty hard to repent of unplowed ground, our lessons not learned, our personality qualities not accomplished. Now, if you'd like these qualities in yourself, then you think of them in other people. It's pretty hard to identify greatness or the other thing in ourselves. During the month of February, we celebrated the birthday of two great American presidents. On February the 14th, I had occasion to read with my son one of Lincoln's anti-slavery debates. His opponent had said, now we can't free the slaves because there are 4 million slaves in the southern states, and they're each worth approximately $1,000 apiece. That makes the economy of the southern states would be upset by $4 billion. That's a lot of money. Then they said, who would get in the cotton and the corn and the tobacco crops? But when Lincoln came to the platform, he brushed all of those arguments aside as immaterial. He said, the only thing that we need to decide here is slavery right or is it wrong? Is it right for some men to have other men in bondage? Now, that's the only question. Now, again, you think what would happen in the world if every one of us had these qualities, if we decided things on Lincoln's formula, or particularly the great leaders of nations. Now, if you can develop those things in yourself, all of your friends will flock around you and ask you to lead them. And I can't think of any more thrilling thing than this, that all of these good qualities are chained to us too. Every good thing that you do incarnates itself. And those qualities that shine so brightly in Lincoln or Gandhi are just as becoming when they're seen by other people in you. Think of this great man, George Washington Carver, who lived in the days of the Southern sharecroppers, when it was the popular thing for someone to move onto the soil and drain out of it all of the fertility possible and then move on and repeat the process in some other location. Now, there are some people who remember George Washington Carver because he made some 300 commercial products out of the common peanut. There are others who remember George Washington Carver because of his great educational effort among the Southern Negro. But I remember George Washington Carver because he said that every human being owes it to himself to leave the soil richer than when he found it. Now, that isn't just a program to build the farm. That's a program to build the farmer. Edwin Markham said, "Why build these cities glorious if man unbuilded goes? In vain we build the world unless the builder also grows." Demosthenes said, it is impossible for one to have a high and noble character while engaged in petty or mean employment. For whatever the pursuits of men are, their characters will be similar. Now, the attitudes that you take to your work or that you take to your schoolwork are going to determine whether it's petty or whether it isn't, and those things that you have in your mind, that's what you are. Now, in conclusion, I'd like to give you some other lines. This is a poem called High Flight. It was written by John Gillespie McGee, a 19-year-old American fighter pilot who was connected with the Royal Canadian Air Force and was shot down over London in the Battle of Britain in the first part of the Second World War. This poem is now found in the Library of Congress under the heading of Poems of Faith and Freedom. Now, to me, and again, I memorize this because your mind is made up by what it feeds upon. What you have in there, it tends to make you what that is. And I memorize it because to me it's something more than some poetry. It's a symbol of accomplishment. Now, here's this young man who had never done any very important thing before he went into the service. Now he feels in his hands, for the first time, the controls of these powerful engines that sends this airplane through space at tremendous speed. And he said, "Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the sky on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed to join the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence hovering there. I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the wind-swept heights with easy grace, where never lark nor even eagle flew. And while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, reached out my hand and touched the face of God." High flight is the essence of great accomplishment. It's the miracle of personality. I thank you.